Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation.
And I'm David Leopold, the Creative Director.
And this week we are talking about New York City Center as seen by Hirschfeld.
Correct. It's its 75th anniversary on December 11th.
Oh, it's coming up.
Yes, indeed. Make sure you wear your party hat.
Oh, I've already got it written in my calendar.
And we're particularly interested because nobody drew more of what City Center did than Al Hirschfeld.
To be fair, nobody drew a lot of things more than Al Hirschfeld. TV
yes.
guide covers.
Yes, that's true. And that
this is just added to the list.
Added to the list. The most of.
Right.
But City Center is a very interesting place because it's really the first true performing arts center in America.
Yeah, set the stage for non-New Yorkers. What exactly is City Center? How did it come into being?
Well, it started, it's on 55th Street between 6th and 7th Avenue, and it started life as a Masonic temple.
Mm.
It was built
the building.
Yeah, the building. Right. In 1924, they opened this building. It was a big deal. It had a massive 3,000-seat auditorium.
Oh, wow.
It had really ornate decoration, very Arabian, you know, for the Masons with their fezes and everything. I mean, the details are incredible. They go down to the doorknobs.
Mm.
You know, it was really very elaborate. Unfortunately, for the Masons, they couldn't afford the taxes after the crash and the Wall Street crash in 1929. And eventually they had to give up the building to the city because of back taxes.
Oh, wow.
Now, the city was looking at this building and thinking it would make a great parking lot.
Which it probably, I mean,
yeah,
well, we always need more parking in New York.
Exactly. And that was the feeling.
Mm.
Fortunately for everyone, except maybe a couple of parking lot attendants,
right.
Mayor LaGuardia, Fiorello LaGuardia, who was the mayor of New York at that time.
And who I call the airport man, and David gets very upset with me.
LaGuardia is so much more than an airport. He was really a remarkable, remarkable leader for New York City during the Depression.
And he was the mayor?
Yeah.
Okay.
Famous for reading the Sunday comics, the Sunday funnies, on the radio for everybody in case you couldn't afford to buy the paper.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah. You know, the Little Flower. Really a remarkable guy. And he, during the Depression, he realized that people needed entertainment and art. And he was staging free concerts and free operas in city parks and whatnot.
Mm.
And he and the city council president, Newbold Morris, wanted to find a place that they could host
an indoor space.
Mm-hmm. They didn't think at all about this Masonic temple. It was a woman, Jean Dalrymple, who was a publicist and an artist manager, sometimes playwright, and even early in her career, an actress, who had a bunch of clients who wanted to put on a concert to support war bonds. And she identified this Masonic temple. It was empty, so it wouldn't require anything other than turning on the lights, turning on the heat. And she convinced the city to let her put on this concert.
Mm.
She invited LaGuardia. Now, in this time, although the story is that it was decided that night, it was already in process. And on December 11th, 1943, they gave this concert for war bonds that was such a success that LaGuardia, Newbold Morris, city council decided that this would really make a great art center. Really, they were thinking about it as a concert hall.
Right.
LaGuardia, as I said, loved music and he loved opera, and he thought that's what they would be presenting there. Jean Dalrymple had a much bigger idea, and indeed she started off as a volunteer, and eventually she would sort of be made the head of it.
And she was a friend of Hirschfeld's.
Jean Dalrymple and Hirschfeld almost certainly were friends. How close they were, I have no idea, but they worked together he did drawings for a lot of her clients and a lot of the performances that she was responsible for. Anybody in the New York arts press would have known Hirschfeld and would have been at parties with him. And Al Hirschfeld was the, you know, the amiable guy, the guy you that everybody enjoyed spending time with. He was just a nice guy.
Yeah.
And he would have seen in Jean Dalrymple somebody who was a real doer and who was making things happen. He would have supported the efforts of City Center because the idea of bringing, in the words of City Center, the best entertainment for the lowest prices, that fit into his ideal as well.
Right, right. Because, you know, you could usually afford the Sunday Times.
Right.
Most people could.
Right, exactly. You didn't have to be rich. His art was very democratic in the sense that it appeared in places, you know, newspapers, walls of theaters, posters. You know, it was art for the masses.
Right.
Really. And as we said in a previous podcast, it really fit into his political ideals.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why he did it, but it was a nice sort of happy byproduct. So Hirschfeld would have gone to many performances at City Center because what happens is they immediately start programming not just music and opera. When I say they did opera, they ended up creating their own company. Mm. New York City Opera was created at City Center, and it would become a very important organization because it was presenting operas at a very low ticket price.
Right.
They couldn't afford to hire, you know, the greatest singers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been too expensive. So it became this platform for younger singers.
Right.
And primarily American singers.
Interesting.
And that allowed a lot of new voices to come into the opera scene. Perhaps the best known is Beverly Sills.
Mm, right.
She tried out for the New York City Opera, I think, 8 times over 3 years.
Oh, wow.
And eventually she got in.
Wow.
And while she made, her first performance was in Die Fledermaus, the thing that really made her a star, she sang the lead role in the Ballad of Baby Doe. And she slowly but surely would go on to perform in, I think, 15 different operas, over 65 performances, between 1955 and 1964.
Mm.
And she would stay with the company for the rest of her career, eventually running it. Eventually she became the director.
Look at that.
Yeah. Hirschfeld drew Beverly Sills not early in his career because he drew very little opera.
He did, yeah, yeah. There's a period in the 80s, I believe, where
late 70s, early 80s.
He draws a lot of Metropolitan Opera drawings.
Yes, these were for radio broadcasts.
Right, right.
And so
there, he did a lot of the advertising for that.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
It's few and far between.
Right, you get the three tenors, some of the late 20th century, very popular opera singers.
Bryn Terfel.
Yeah, exactly. But for most of his career, he didn't draw opera.
Right.
But Beverly Sills was one of those performers, like a Pavarotti, who
transcends the genre.
Exactly. Yeah. Couldn't have said it better.
Well, thank you, David.
And she became a personality that a lot of people knew.
Mm.
I mean, they would do specials on TV, and she sang with Carol Burnett.
Mm.
You know, it was that kind of thing. People knew Beverly Sills. She was essentially
a household name.
Yeah, household name and their sort of entry into the world of opera.
Mm-hmm.
And she had the kind of face that was perfect for Hirschfeld to draw.
Yeah,
And she was known as Bubbles to her friends.
Bubbles, that looks like, yeah, I could see that.
She was a Brooklyn girl, you know, and I'm sure she knew Hirschfeld and Hirschfeld knew her.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great black and white drawing that he did of her. And there's also a color sort of a color version of the same drawing.
Yeah, it's very similar. It's very similar to that black and white drawing. The black and white one was made into a print.
Yes.
And then the color is a stereo review cover. And
yes.
That's another podcast episode we haven't even thought about. All the stereo review covers are just beautiful.
Yeah, they're really beautiful.
Ray Charles.
Earl Hines.
Yeah.
Frank Sinatra.
There's some really great ones.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Is there an
Isaac Stern?
Yes, there's a great Isaac Stern and Eugene Ormandy.
Oh, yeah, the Ormandy is the one I was thinking of, yeah.
So now, music was a big part of City Center, certainly at the beginning.
Mm-hmm,
Leopold Stokowski actually created the New York Symphony there.
Oh,
and it was a really great time because so many musicians, and really Stokowski himself,
mm-hmm.
We're talking about 43, 44, you couldn't travel in Europe. The war was on.
Oh, right.
They were all in New York.
Mm.
So he had really the sort of pick of the litter.
Mm.
And for the and he thought it was very important to bring classical music to everyone.
Everyone.
Leopold Stokowski started the New York City Symphony at City Center as a way to bring classical music to a wide range of people at a low ticket price. And he even gave his own money to make it happen. I don't think he took a fee for conducting or bringing the orchestra together.
It was his passion project.
Right. It was something he felt very strongly about. Mm-hmm. I think we lose sight today that especially in mid-century America, there was a civic pride that we were in this together. You know, the country had gone through the Depression.
Now
they were going through World War II. And we were all on the same side.
Right.
And the idea of doing something for your fellow, in this case, New Yorkers, mm-hmm. or your fellow Americans, that was a source of pride. Mm. It wasn't as if you were giving a handout to somebody.
Right.
It was a way of saying, I'm an American too, and I want to do my part.
Right.
It was a period of sacrifice. And so Leopold Stokowski was giving of his time and of his money to help this come into being.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the war ended, he was very much in demand in Europe, and he wanted to fulfill those commitments. It was important for him and a lot of musicians, a lot of performers, to go back to Europe to support their countries.
Stokowski wasn't American. He was born in England.
Yes, yeah. Polish descent.
Right,
but,
right,
born
with
in
his
England.
Name, but born in England. Yeah.
Right. And there was just this general sense, you've got to go back now
mm-hmm.
and help rebuild
right.
what had been destroyed in World War II.
Right.
So City Center was at a loss. I mean, how do you replace Leopold Stokowski?
Right.
And he suggested, and they thought it was a great idea, to get this very young but very popular conductor from the New York Philharmonic who had been making a name for himself. And I think you've heard of him. His name is Leonard Bernstein.
Yes, yes. And to me, Bernstein's always the poor man's Carrion, but that's beside the point.
Please, Leonard Bernstein family members, it's not me. It's Catherine Eastman.
Well, he was a great admirer and student of Carrion's.
Oh, sure.
I believe. So,
well, they had a passion in Mahler.
They strangely look the same. Yeah. So I'm okay with Bernstein. So
well,
Bernstein comes onto the
scene.
Bernstein
was this very... He was a young person's conductor.
Right.
You know, here's all these white-haired
old
guys.
Yep.
And then here's...
Boy, that doesn't sound familiar.
Yeah. And then here's Leonard Bernstein, who makes a name for himself, taking over the baton one night with almost no preparation on a mm-hmm. radio broadcast and making a big hit. And, you know, Leonard Bernstein had ambitions. And so now he was being offered his own symphony to conduct.
Wow.
And he jumped at it.
Yeah, I bet.
It was 1946. You know, the kids, the young people who went, Lenny was their guy.
Right.
You know, and he proved to be incredibly popular.
Mm.
And this was a place that people, I mean, he brought all these young people into classical music.
Right.
You know, at the same time, he's already just written the music for On the Town. Mm. And, you know, he's becoming the polymath that he was. And in fact, Hirschfeld draws him in 1946 for Seventeen magazine.
Yes, a few of Seventeen magazine drawings from the 50s.
From the 40s,
excuse me. And everybody's always surprised when we tell them, you know, oh, this was from Seventeen magazine. They all say, what, Seventeen? Yeah. Yeah, it was Frank Sinatra, Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman.
Oh yeah, Glenn Miller, all these great jazz figures.
Yep.
In every issue of Seventeen magazine from its very first issue in 1944, for the first 2 years, there was a Hirschfeld in every issue.
Wow.
And it only stops when Hirschfeld leaves the country for 9 months.
For Westward Ha.
Well, for Westward Ha. And when he comes back, the focus is no longer on musicians, but it's on Hollywood stars. Mm, and he does a series of drawings for them.
Right.
And that goes close to the end of the 40s.
Yeah.
But Leonard Bernstein was a musical figure that young people, and if you were 17,
mm-hmm.
Leonard Bernstein was right up your alley.
I could see it.
And it's the first time he shows Leonard Bernstein playing piano, conducting, writing.
And writing, yeah.
You know, it's
the classic Hirschfeld, multiple hands.
Yes. And So now this would be the only real music drawing that he did of anybody at City Center.
Right.
What City Center was known for and what it's still known for is dance, which is funny because LaGuardia was not a big fan of dance. He didn't understand, you know, men jumping around in tights.
Right, right.
He was uncomfortable with it. Fortunately, he was the minority opinion on that.
And he was not in charge.
Right. Exactly. Because that's what's interesting about City Center as well. Although the city owned the building, they did not really run it.
They were not a city institution.
They were not.
Yeah. I mean, affiliated officially.
The first years, they were very involved in the budgeting and the planning and whatnot. But the whole idea was to make City Center self-sufficient.
Right, right.
And so their biggest contribution was not money, it was time. They leased the building for like $1 a year.
Oh, wow.
They did maintenance on the building, which is substantial.
Sure, it's a huge building.
It is a huge building.
And we said before, ornate building.
Yeah, and it's, well, what's interesting, crazy actually, is the theater, the auditorium, had all this ornate decoration, and sometime by the late 40s, they decided to whitewash it all because they thought it was, I don't know, maybe too distracting or
No.
You know, they weren't trying to erase the Masonic Temple, but they weren't a Masonic Temple.
Right, right.
And so it would be much more normal for them to have
plain
walls.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the decoration in City Center, in the hallways and the lobbies, was covered over with white paint.
No.
And it was that way for 30 years. They only started bringing it back in the 80s, and in 2011 they did an incredible restoration where they didn't bring it back to exactly what it was, but they based the designs on the kinds of things that were there.
Right.
And to go in there now, it's really incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, so here's the other thing. It's a 3,000-seat auditorium at first. It was not set up for musical performances. It wasn't set up for any type of performance.
It was like a high school auditorium or something. Yeah,
exactly. And there was no amplification. They actually, early on, they realized they needed microphones to reach, you know, so everyone could hear. And they didn't know where to get them. And the Connecticut legislature was on summer break in the summer of 1944. And they, I don't know how it worked, but they borrowed the microphones and amplification that the Connecticut legislature had. And they brought it down to City Center so they could use it.
That's funny.
I mean, it's weird. I mean, but it's all part of the history. Now, the first dance company that ever performed at City Center was the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo.
Right.
And Hirschfeld didn't draw them at that time, although he had drawn them 10 years earlier in a really wonderful, sort of exciting 1933 drawing.
Yeah, classic 30s drawing. Signed in Russian.
Signed in Russian. So
it must have been in Russia.
Don't call Robert Mueller.
Was it in Russia?
No, he didn't. This was in New York.
So he just chose because it was the Ballet Russe.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Interesting.
One of their early attractions was Paul Draper and Larry Adler. Paul Draper was a great dancer, and Larry, this seems like such an unlikely act, but this was extremely popular. Paul Draper would dance, and Larry Adler would play the harmonica.
That sounds fun.
It was must have been exciting to watch. They became a regular feature.
Was it sort of like a country, like I would think it was like a country type?
No, they did all kinds of things.
Oh, okay.
All kinds of things. They toured all over the country, probably all over the world.
Wow.
No, well, and now the one of the leading choreographers for the Ballet Russe was a young Russian dancer and choreographer. I'm sure you've heard of him, George Balanchine.
Who?
Balanchine and Lincoln Kirstein had been trying to create a school of ballet since the mid-30s.
Oh, wow.
And it had gone through several iterations. They had come up with the ballet theater. He was working with the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. But when they came to City Center, I think they saw this as, this could be our home.
Right.
And they understood that it was presenting a wide range of things. Because, I mean, after the first concert, a week later, the first performances really start happening there.
Right.
And it's Gertrude Lawrence in Susan and God, which had been a hit on Broadway a few years earlier, and Sidney Kingsley allowed them to do The Patriots, a play that he had written several years earlier.
No, I thought the first performance was Monte Carlo.
Well, that was the first dance performance.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That happens in early 1944.
Gotcha.
But that's the thing is, here they all of a sudden had this performing arts center, so they had to book it.
Right.
They had to fill.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah. And so they scrambled around and they got whatever they could get.
Okay, yeah.
And...
And
the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo had been performing at the Met, but they wanted to reach the masses. They felt that ticket prices and just the feeling was too snobby over there.
We know about ticket prices at the Met.
Yeah.
We know all about it.
Peter Galba, if you're listening. anyway, they wanted to reach a wider audience. Mm-hmm. Gene Dalrymple said the first time glamour came to City Center was when the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo came. I mean, it was they brought in all these people who loved dance, who came to the opening in chauffeur limousines and, you know, wore tuxedos and gowns and things like that. Right. And it was a big deal because other times they were really servicing people from their audience was made up of just about anybody from any of the five boroughs of New York. They had a $2 top ticket, and it was, as I said, it was made to be low prices for so everybody could come.
So, David, you've mentioned several times, you know, the low ticket price. Was that called popular prices?
Oh, yeah.
Is that what that was, like, the slogan?
That was a slogan.
Yeah.
And it was much more, I mean, it was for everything, but when they started doing theater, that was a really big deal.
Gotcha, yeah.
Because when they brought in theater, the first things they brought in were shows that had been hits on Broadway, had gone out on tour, and they would finish their tour by doing a couple of weeks at City Center.
Right. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
No,
let's
I want to talk about dance.
To dance, yeah.
So Balanchine starts the New York City Ballet at City Center in 1948. And it becomes probably the most important dance company in America.
Hmm.
You really can't talk about dance in America without realizing the role that City Center played.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only was it the birthplace and the home of the New York City Ballet, and that meant Balanchine from 1948 to 1964, when the New York City Ballet moved to Lincoln Center, created really some of his greatest works that were first performed on the stage at City Center.
Right.
In the same year that they started New York City Ballet, a young dancer and budding choreographer saw it. His name was Jerome Robbins. He wrote Balanchine and said, "This is exactly the kind of company that I would like to be a part of, and I'm happy to do anything you want me to do." And Balanchine said, "Come on." And eventually, Robbins came there as a dancer, but also as a choreographer. So all of his important early works were also premiered and were created at City Center.
Right.
Some of the great dancers, Melissa Hayden, you know, like the New York City Opera was the first major opera company who had on contract African American performers, Camilla Williams and Todd Duncan. Todd Duncan was the first Porgy and Porgy and Bess.
Oh, gotcha.
And the New York City Ballet was also that kind of company. Arthur Mitchell, who recently passed away, great dancer, was the first African American ever signed to be a principal dancer at an American ballet company.
Oh, wow.
So that was sort of what New York City Center was all about. It was not about perpetuating the same old things.
Right.
It was really, it was a place that looked like its audience.
Right, right.
Again, Hirschfeld didn't draw too many individual ballets there. He would draw, there's actually a great drawing of the New York City Ballet performing on Omnibus, which was on TV in 1955, hosted by Alistair Cook. And the drawing shows, I think, Queen Elizabeth, who was getting coronated at that time, and Helen Hayes was performed something. This was a show that was kind of like City Center. Omnibus showed many different genres of dance,
right?
Not of dance, of performing arts in one program. at a very high level of sophistication. Mm. And that's what City Center was doing. So later on, he does a drawing of Arthur Mitchell and Suzanne Farrell doing Slaughter on 10th Avenue.
Right.
When it enters the New York City Ballet Repertory. He would eventually draw Balanchine rehearsing in 1974, after 10 years after he had left City Center. Mm. But it could have been a drawing of Balanchine at City Center.
Sure, sure.
Then the other great dance companies that were there. The Joffrey Ballet was really just a small, struggling ballet company until they came to City Center. They had a great 2-week season there, and this was after the New York City Ballet had left, and they were invited to become a resident company, so they became City Center Joffrey Ballet.
So did they like replace New York City Ballet?
Yes.
Okay, once they went to Lincoln Center.
So Lincoln Center was built in 1964,
right,
in part to house productions that had been at City Center, because City Center understood that its space was limited to some extent.
Right.
And then in a last-minute backroom drama, Lincoln Center tried to ace out City Center from being involved in Lincoln Center. Mm. But the fact is, it was literally written into the founding documents of Lincoln Center. And City Center, the City Center of Music and Drama, I think still manages the State Theater, where the ballet and the opera performed.
Oh, wow.
And they did a lot of – Lincoln Center did a lot of things that City Center did.
Right.
And to some way, to the detriment of City Center. Mm. But City Center didn't just stop when the New York City Opera and the New York City Ballet left.
Right.
They started new things.
Right.
And so one of those new things was the City Center Joffrey Ballet. And for Joffrey, it ended up being – the decisive moment in their career.
I bet.
They really make a commitment to doing both new work and reviving older work. Mm. They're the first and perhaps only dance company ever to be featured on Time magazine's cover. Wow. And that happens when they're at City Center. They get on Life magazine's cover as well, with different very contemporary ballets. And they would stay at City Center until I think about 1975.
Now, are there any drawings of Joffrey?
There is only one drawing of the Joffrey Ballet in a drawing called A Night of Stars.
Okay. It's a composite.
Of, he showed different things. Kitty Carlisle Hart's there, right, and I think Gregory Hines, and Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson. Right. I mean, it's a crazy collection. It was a special event that was happening in Florida at the time.
Gotcha.
So he didn't really draw the Joffrey Ballet. He would, of course, draw lots of dancers for the rhythm portfolio around that time. So the other dance companies that were part of City Center and still are part of City Center, in 1971, the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, a really, really important dance company and one of the great American dance companies, they were going through a financial crisis. They needed a new home, and they started to present seasons at City Center, and they've been doing it for close to 50 years now.
And do we have any drawings of that?
There's no drawings of any particular performances. Well, that's not true. In 2002, there is a drawing of Judith Jameson, who became the artistic director of the Ailey American Dance Theater. After Alvin Ailey's death, the handpicked successor, doing a dance called Echo Far From Home.
That was from 1998.
1998, correct. And then he did a wonderful drawing of Judith Jameson in a Broadway show called The Only World in Town in 1977.
Right.
But it could have been Judith Jameson doing any of her great dances, Cry, right, Revelations, that first premiered at City Center. Martha Graham would eventually bring her company and presented their New York seasons at City Center. Mm. As she would do, I think, nine world premieres actually there,
wow,
including her final work, Maple Leaf Rag, in 1990. Hirschfeld did two portraits of Martha Graham in the late 80s, and right, it was at this time she was doing all of her New York work at City Center. So when you're talking, when I say that you can't talk about Dance in America without talking about City Center, it's because home of New York City Ballet, one time the home of the Joffrey Ballet, Alvin Ailey, Merce Cunningham, who is a very different type of dancer, actually makes his first appearance with the New York City Ballet in 1948 at City Center. Eventually, it creates its own company, and in 1978, starts to present their New York seasons at City Center. Had at least five or six world premieres. Hirschfeld drew Cunningham near the end of his career, and once in a drawing with all of Merce's stuff, TVs and bicycle wheels that were classic parts of what he did in 1999. And then in 2000, he did a drawing of Merce Cunningham and Paul Taylor, who were the two great male modern dancers. Paul Taylor first appeared at City Center in the 50s, started his own company, had his first world premiere at City Center in 1969 with Private Domain, and starting in 1977 to 2011, presented annual seasons at City Center every year and premiered a lot of work or New York premieres. Twyla Tharp, her company performed their New York seasons fairly frequently at City Center. And the only drawing of Twyla Tharp was when she did Moving Out with Billy Joel. So it's sort of just the conclusion of her time at City Center. And it wasn't for a production at City Center, but it's very much what she was doing at City Center.
Right.
If you have the chance, every fall they do something called the Fall for Dance Festival. They bring in companies from all over the country and all over the world, premiering new work or doing some of their sort of their greatest hits. For 2 weeks, every seat in the theater is $15.
Wow.
And it is an incredible experience. If you want to see the great dance that's going on right now, from anywhere.
Right.
These 2 weeks in October is the Fall for Dance Festival at City Center is the place you have to be. And of course, all during the year, Alvin Ailey presents their series there. Dance Theater of Harlem presents their Lars Lubavitch. I mean, everybody. I mean, if you're in dance, you have performed at City Center and you're probably still performing at City Center. Then there's one other thing that's not exactly dance and it's not exactly theater. It is a French performer, pantomimist, by the name of Marcel Marceau.
Right.
Really, again, if you're talking about mid-20th century and you talked about mime, were talking about Marcel
Marceau.
Who else
are you going to talk about?
Right. he starts performing in America and he thinks he'd like to come at City Center, but he's like, I don't know if it'll what I do, which is literally one man on stage, will work in this massive auditorium.
Right. That's a fair concern.
Right. Well, it turns out what he did could be read by the last row of the last balcony.
Oh, wow.
And he became another fixture at City Center, presenting annual performances there for decades.
Wow.
In fact, the film Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
There is a scene of Marcel Marceau, this would be the late 60s, performing at City Center.
Oh, that's funny.
Hirschfeld drew him several times at City Center. Once doing, it was later redrawn and published as a print of Marcel Marceau running in a windstorm.
Yeah.
And it's a great piece.
He's got all the feet.
Yeah, Marceau has probably about 6 feet.
Yeah.
There's another one where he's captured a butterfly. And then he would do a piece in which he did it for a limited edition print of Marcel Marceau not doing anything except being Marceau. And he was, of course, the perfect kind of performer that Hirschfeld liked to draw because there was no words. It was all movement. It was all expressive language through movement. And that was perfect for Hirschfeld. So it's not surprising that over the years, Hirschfeld did not one but two prints, an etching and a lithograph, and did some wonderful drawings. And those were all taken from performances at City Center.
Oh, wow.
So he is, as I said, the bridge between dance and theater.
Right, it's right in between.
Right, exactly. And Hirschfeld drew more theater at City Center than anything else.
Right.
One of the first productions at City Center was Paul Robeson in Othello.
Mm.
Now, Robeson was the first black actor in America,
right,
to play Othello, on a, you know, in a major production.
Right.
It was a controversial production.
I'm sure.
Because Uta Hagen played Desdemona.
Oh.
And, you know, the black and the white then, the only place they really got along was in Hirschfeld drawings.
Right, right.
But Jose Ferrer, who was married to Uta Hagen, played Iago.
Mm.
The production was a big hit, longest running Shakespeare in Broadway history.
Oh, wow.
It eventually toured the country.
Mm.
And as it was winding down its tour, City Center asked Robeson and Uta Hagen and Jose Ferrer if they would bring the production to City Center to be able to present it at a low ticket price.
Right.
And Uta Hagen and Jose Ferrer were all for it. Robeson had some concerns. The critics had been very good to him in New York, had been very nice to him, and had been praiseworthy of his production. But he wasn't sure he wanted to give them a second chance.
Right.
And he resisted until a dinner. Gene Dalrymple invited Robeson, Uta Hagen, Jose Ferrer, and LaGuardia to dinner at her home.
Mm.
And LaGuardia essentially buttonholed Robeson and told him it was his duty.
Oh, wow.
To perform this at a low price so that New Yorkers could see the work.
Right.
And, you know, for a $2 top ticket. And that convinced Robeson. Mm. So he brought it in. Hirschfeld didn't draw that production. He drew the original Broadway production, but for all intents and purposes, it might as well have been the same production. Another early show that went in that had been on Broadway, had toured, and would continue touring was The Merry Widow.
Mm.
That's also 45 that they do it. Hirschfeld drew the original Broadway production and not necessarily the City Center production.
Merry Widow's 43.
43. Well, that's when it appeared on Broadway.
Oh, I'm sorry. The drawing's from 1943. The City Center production is 45.
Right, but it was virtually identical.
Right, right. And that's what they were doing. They were taking the hit Broadway shows and then bringing them to City Center after.
You essentially saw the road company.
Right, right.
Because they didn't have the wherewithal to create their own company. They wanted to fill the space. The first show that they did, the first musical that was done at City Center was The New Moon.
And that, like, of their people?
No, that was also someone else's production.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
It was a company of 100. You know, that's when you had big companies. They took their first big musical hit at City Center was Carmen Jones, Oscar Hammerstein's Carmen Jones. Mm-hmm. And over 3 weeks, it played to 50,000 people at City Center. Wow. This is in 1945.
But they're still bringing shows in at that point.
Right, exactly. They don't start producing their own shows until the late 40s. One of the first ones was something that Hirschfeld drew. It was, I'm wrong about that. Maurice Evans was an actor manager who brought shows to Broadway and then would tour around the country. He was of that generation of troopers that believed you did a Broadway season and then it was your obligation to take it across the country.
Catherine Cornell.
Right, exactly. Like Catherine Cornell. He brought his production of Man and Superman to City Center. They used Hirschfeld's drawing as the poster.
Mm-hmm.
This had George Bernard Shaw sort of standing over.
Yeah.
Well, very much similar to the My Fair Lady idea. He is sort of crouched over a proscenium stage, and he's operating the marionettes of Maurice Evans and a woman, the female lead in the show.
Frances Rowe.
Now, Evans liked it so much that he was asked to become the director of the New York Theater Company. And so the next play that he did, the next Shaw that he did, he started at City Center.
Oh, nice.
And that was The Devil's Disciple.
Okay.
And Hirschfeld did a drawing for The Times that appeared the Sunday before the show opened.
Mm-hmm.
He would also do a drawing for the Playbill cover.
Right. And now this is the Playbill at City Center?
Oh, yeah, Playbill at City Center, okay. And then on Broadway as well.
Right, right.
And it was a big hit at City Center, and it would go on to be a big hit on Broadway, and it would tour the country. Mm. Maurice Evans did a season there. Then Jose Ferrer was asked to lead the company, and he did very interesting plays, Volpone, which was, I think, a restoration comedy, and classic Hirschfeld brings us into the rehearsal room with Jose Ferrer and Richard Worf and Paula Lawrence, you know, his old girlfriend. And interestingly enough, right before this, he had drawn Dolly Huss, his second wife, in her great Broadway performance, which was the Lute Song, which they had revived to just play at City Center. So there's a drawing of the insect comedy with George Coloris.
I like that one.
Yeah, it's a really fun, and I think kind of a different type of drawing.
Yeah.
The way he does the fabric of Coloris's clothes is, I think, very contemporary for the time, and probably very accurate to what he was wearing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You don't see Hirschfeld sort of scribble like that in a lot of drawings.
Yeah.
So there was a revival of The Heiress, Ruth and Gus Gutz's The Heiress with Basil Rathbone. And I don't think Wendy Hiller played it there.
Margaret Phillips.
Yeah. Right. Then they started, Dream Girl with Judy Holliday had been a hit on Broadway, and they brought that in soon, actually, after it closed on Broadway, even before it went on tour. They started their own theater. They had started their own theater company. They were looking for plays to do. Now, here's the thing is they couldn't do new plays because Broadway producers were understandably nervous that if City Center started to do new plays at a $2 top ticket,
nobody would then buy the Broadway price after.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
So City Center became the first organization in New York devoted to reviving shows. And that doesn't sound like such an incredible thing.
Right. Now, not today, where everything's a revival.
A lot of things are revivals.
I'm going to stick by my original statement. Everything's a revival.
But in the 1940s and 1950s, revivals were almost unheard of.
Right. Well, because there's not that...
there wasn't a body of work to pull from.
Right.
That is true. But also, you know... Rodgers and Hammerstein didn't want to revive an old show. They wanted to do a new show.
Yeah.
George Kaufman was writing new shows every season.
Right.
Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, they were writing new shows every season. It was a popular form of entertainment. And
do you think they thought people don't want to see it again? Do you think they thought people always wanted something new?
I think there was a lot of feeling of that.
And they didn't think it was worthy of a revival?
Right. I mean, as you said, there wasn't a huge body of work to pull from. And the idea of doing something old when you could do something new.
Right, right.
You know, you have to think of where America's at in the late 40s, early 50s.
Right.
It's all about what's going to happen next.
Right.
You know, the new world has triumphed over the old world.
Yeah, we don't want the old crap.
Right. I mean, I don't know if they thought about it just like that, but.
I think they did.
So they start, they're just reviving shows. They revive George Kaufman's, a show that's never been revived in New York, save for this time, George Kaufman, Catherine Drayton comedy called First Lady. They brought in, Helen, Galahan, had been a Broadway star. And then she served 3 terms in Congress.
Wow.
And then she went back to acting. So she was the perfect person to play this.
Yeah.
And they revived Shakespeare, All's Well That Ends Well.
Showboat.
Showboat. They did a great production of Showboat with Burl Ives. The musicals started in 1954. They started the New York City Center Light Opera Company.
Mm.
And light opera companies at that time were pretty prevalent all over the country.
And does that mean like musical theater?
Musical theater. Yeah. It's exactly what it was considered. And musicals at that time were considered light operas.
Right. Right.
You know, and there's still
That's how I guessed what it meant.
There are still many great light opera associations all across the country. But in the 40s and 50s, that was a big deal.
Right.
And there was a whole sort of network. So you could do shows and travel around at these different light opera companies. I don't know if City Center's productions actually traveled because they usually got some pretty big name talent. It was all part and parcel of what was going on in America.
Right.
In 1952, they need some money for what was then just the New York Theater New York City Theater Company. And Gene Dalrymple runs into Jose Ferrer on the street and asks him for a donation of $1,000. Which is a lot of money, but Jose Ferrer was a big star at that time, both on Broadway and in Hollywood. And Jose Ferrer says, I can do you one better. I'll give you the $1,000 and I'll do a whole season for you.
Oh, wow.
And he does. He does.
Now, this is before he was the theater guy.
No, no.
He before he was in charge of.
No, no. So
I thought he was in charge of.
He had been in charge. He had left. Oh, okay. Other people had taken over.
And now,
she was saying help. And he said, I'll come back and do a season.
Yeah, okay.
In which he does four plays that he not only he directs three of them and stars in all four.
Right.
And Hirschfeld did a great, great drawing of Jose Ferrer in the four different roles of the Shrike, which you've never heard of, Richard III, which he had never done in New York before. The Shrike had been a hit on Broadway. He did Cyrano de Bergerac,
of course,
which was literally his go-to role.
Right.
If anybody remembered any show that Jose Ferrer did, it would be Cyrano. And then the other show that he was intimately associated with was Charlie's Aunt.
Oh, yes.
So he did this season, and Hirschfeld does a drawing of four Jose Ferrers sort of lined up on a stage with his character in Charlie's Aunt poking out from behind a curtain. It's really great. Jose Ferrer thought it was so great that he bought it. He acquired a lot of his drawings. They both lived in the Osborne apartment building at that time on 57th Street.
Hirschfeld and Ferrer.
Jose Ferrer. And sometimes they would go to the theater together.
Aww.
I mean, Hirschfeld would drive him to the theater because Hirschfeld was always driving someplace.
Well, and he always got the perfect spot.
That was his great gift. He would always get a good parking spot. But Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy did the four poster there, and Hirschfeld drew that. In 1955, they were thinking about doing they were going to do Mr. Roberts, the World War II play.
Mm-hmm.
And Franco Tone was going to be the lead, and he got very excited about it. Well, the producers, Leland Hayward and Josh Logan, who had produced the original production, and Logan, who had directed it, got wind that they wanted to revive it, but they had been working on a film adaptation, and they were worried that this revival would interfere with their success as film, so City Center had to scrap it, and they didn't know what they were going to do, and quickly, Gene Dalrymple thought that William Saroyan's The Time of Your Life would be a great play for them to do. And Franco Tone loved it. One of the people they cast was Gloria Vanderbilt, an old Hirschfeld friend.
Yeah.
And the show, of course, Gene Dalrymple wanted to create publicity. What she couldn't have fathomed is that Gloria Vanderbilt, who was married, because it's a small world, to Leopold Stokowski at the time.
Oh my goodness.
She announced their divorce like 2 weeks before the show opened. Well, that was perfect. Worldwide celebrity news.
Yeah.
And it garnered a tremendous amount of publicity for the show.
Any publicity is good publicity.
That is exactly right. Also that same year, in that same season, they did a production of Othello with another black actor, William Marshall, who would really become the great Othello in the second half of the 20th century.
Right.
He would perform it at least six different times. He recorded it, he filmed it. It was a great performance. They brought back Carmen Jones, they revived it, and it was a show that went out on tour, and Hirschfeld's drawing of the revival would be used on programs all across the country. They would do these spring seasons of all musicals, and oftentimes it would be Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, because even at that time, they were like the gold standard.
Right.
Everyone loved a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, or for that matter, a Rodgers and Hart musical. And Richard Rodgers was I mean, nobody had been reviving shows. These shows were getting a second life. He was pretty thrilled. Mm-hmm. In fact, they would do Carousel with Barbara Cook. And Brooks Atkinson thought it was a better production than the original Broadway production, which is saying something. Well, they did so much Rodgers and Hammerstein and Rodgers and Hart that people started to complain, aren't there other people? And they did some Cole Porter, too, and other things. And so she wanted to do a season of musicals that weren't Rodgers and Hart or Rodgers and Hammerstein. And so right after Say Darling, a Comden and Green, Julie Stein musical with Robert Morse closed on Broadway, 2 weeks later it opened at City Center for like a 2 or 3 week run. But Barbara Cook, one of her great performances she considered in her career was The King and I at City Center that she did with Farley Granger. And they produced a great amount of sort of frisson and sort of sexual energy. Even though there was nothing going on between them, she's like, whatever that chemistry is, we had it. Yeah, and it was sexy as hell. And she had only fond memories of City Center. City Center was the first place that critics started to take Barbara Cook seriously. She had done Oklahoma there and two different productions of Carousel, eventually The King and I. And she got the first great reviews of her career right there. In 1960, they bring in the Kabuki Theater, the Grand Kabuki, which had never performed in America before.
Oh, wow.
And it's crazy. Hirschfeld does an incredible drawing.
Yeah.
In which he signs, this is the United Nations of shows, because he signs this drawing in Japanese.
Right. It's like, it's vertical.
Vertical, as it would be.
In he really Japanese. Does. He does it.
What's interesting about in doing research about the City Center productions, so the Grand Kabuki comes to City Center, and fortunately, it's right at the time where there's a strike on Broadway over pay and working conditions, and for 3 weeks there's no Broadway shows, and it coincides with the performances of the Grand Kabuki, so a lot of actors come and see, because each week they change the program.
And because City Center's not Broadway.
Right, exactly.
So they keep going.
Exactly. Yeah. Although some of their performances would be considered Broadway, I think one of the other great pieces that he did at City Center, he again takes us into the rehearsal room, and it's Bob Fosse playing the lead in Pal Joey.
Oh,
this was essentially the dream role of Bob Fosse. He had understudied it on Broadway, never had a chance to play it. They asked him to do it in 1961, and he loved it, played the entire show with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, he was essentially the Pal Joey character. And so,
so it was easy.
It was easy for him. They toured around a little bit with it. And in 1963, they asked him to do it again. And it's the only time Bob Fosse got nominated for a Tony as a performer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Theater would end at City Center in about the mid-60s after once Lincoln Center, Richard Rodgers starts his own musical theater at Lincoln Center. And so eventually none of their shows are available. The actors and actresses who had been playing for scale...
Right.
You know, if you were going to play at City Center for scale or Lincoln Center for top dollar, you're going to play at Lincoln Center. And it really ends up sort of killing the musical theater program at City Center. And as I said, City Center goes on after Lincoln Center, but it's hobbled. And it goes into the 70s in a really weakened position. At one point, it looks like it's going to close.
Oh, no.
And a group of people led by Howard Squadron get it. Landmark status, and they create a new corporation that's just going to be devoted to dance. And for most of the 70s and 80s, that's all that's going on. You know, there's still rentals, the things that come in. Monty Python comes in 1976 for like a week or two of performances. They record an album there. Richard Pryor records parts of an album there, a live album there. Barry Manilow plays there. I mean, all kinds of things happen, but it's primarily a dance house. And then in 1994, they start to do something. They want to bring musical theater back in.
Right.
They can't afford to mount huge productions. Mm. So they come up with this idea of doing concert versions of musicals.
Right.
And they call it the Encore series. The first one is appropriately Fiorello, the musical about LaGuardia.
Yeah.
And right away, people love it. Mm. Even though they're just up there in sort of evening clothes.
Right, right. With microphones.
With microphones, yeah. With scripts.
Right.
You know, to hear these shows again that you didn't get to hear that often, it was a great experience. They got great Broadway performers. It was a short, it was like 10 days of rehearsal and maybe 5 to 7 performances. You would do it in about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. It's totally insane, totally crazy. But it was sort of like summer stock used to be, where you would have 1 week and 2 weeks summer stock where you were rehearsing and performing a show in literally no time. Well, in 1996, they decide to do a what they say is a concert version of Chicago, the Candor and Ebb musical.
Right.
But Walter Bobby, who had been the music director, was directing it. He had a very clear idea of what he wanted to do, and it was the first time they took the performers out of evening clothes, and very simple but very seductive costumes were given to all the performers. And if you ask anybody who was there, the final dress rehearsal, I mean, the place exploded after the performance. They couldn't believe it. Everybody knew that this could not just stay at City Center. And eventually, it is brought to Broadway.
Right.
It's the only time that Hirschfeld draws essentially an encore production.
Right.
This show, I mean, it's a revival of a show that in 1975 had opened on Broadway, had been drawn by Hirschfeld, Bob Fosse. You know, it was really a Bob Fosse show. Mm-hmm. And it had been a minor hit in 1975, but it was too cynical for 1975. Mm. But in 1996, it wasn't too cynical at all. In fact, it seemed to be just right.
Mm.
You know, sort of time had caught up with this musical. And if you're saying, oh, is that the Chicago that's running today? It is the Chicago that is running today.
Wow.
It is the longest running American musical on Broadway and the second longest running musical in Broadway history.
Wow.
You know, beat only by
Phantom, of course. I never let David forget.
I let her say it every show because she loves it. Although Hirschfeld wouldn't draw Encore's productions, he would... he was a regular, he went to all of them, usually on Sunday afternoons. Mm. And I just speculate that he probably waited until they made sure they knew what they were doing.
They get everything right.
But of course, a lot of the shows he had drawn originally.
Right.
A lot of the shows were written by people that he knew.
Right.
I mean, for him. And that was like looking in the past, and Hirschfeld was not a guy who looked in the past.
Yeah.
But he really liked great performances. He really liked great shows and great songs. So he loved it. And luckily we have one record
Great
that.
One. The only one you need.
Yeah, exactly.
Really.
Well, I mean, the longest running American musical on Broadway being a revival, no less.
Right.
It's just really, it's really remarkable. What got us thinking about all this, in addition to the 75th anniversary, is the fact that I put together an exhibition on this history that uses Hirschfeld drawings, but not exclusively Hirschfeld drawings. One is at the Performing Arts Library at Lincoln Center. We've talked about it before. Yeah. And one is over at City Center itself.
Yeah.
They're both free and open to the public. You can see about 25 drawings in both exhibitions.
And, each. So there's 50 if you go to both.
No, it's not 50 altogether. Oh. There's 13 in one and 18 in another.
Oh, 18. Maybe I thought they were both 18.
Yeah. There's one or two prints in each one. Beverly Sills is in both shows. The two different Marcel Marceaus. Yep.
So there's one in each show. You got to go to each to see both.
Beverly Sills is the only repeat. Mm-hmm. But there's all kinds of other things. You'll see at Lincoln Center a wall devoted to all the dancers that have performed there. There's a whole section on the musical theater history. There are cases full of really wonderful and weird props. It's probably the only time an electric chair has been at Lincoln Center.
Assassins,
nice. Of course. Yes, indeed. But we've got all kinds of things there. Mm. And over at City Center, you can see things that are from the backstage and pieces of what it looked like in the 20s.
Right.
You can see the leading ladies of a City Center. You can see these wonderful photographs from Jerome Robbins performances or ballets that have been performed there. It's really great. I encourage everyone to see it. The Lincoln Center show is up until March 2nd, and the City Center installation is up through June. So thank you very much for listening. We've given you an opportunity to not only, you can look at the images in the show notes. Catherine always puts them there.
Yep.
And this is one of those rare instances where you can actually go out and see the original drawings as well. Not everyone that we talked about, but a lot of them.
There's a lot of them, though. Yeah, for sure. So we're on Facebook, the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, Twitter and Instagram at Al Hirschfeld. The podcast is alhirschfeldfoundation.org/podcasts. S for Stokowski. Yeah, nice. That was a good one.
Our theme music is by the wonderful, legendary Dick Hyman. And you can learn more about Dick and his music at dickhyman.com. If you want to berate us about something, give us a piece of advice, suggest an idea for a show.
You can send that to David at info@alhirschfeldfoundation.org.
It's just info at
That's what I said. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. No, it's not David info. It's just info. All right. So we hope you enjoy, and we will see you soon.